Title for today's class, Before I Was Afflicted, I Went Astray. Brother Colin.
Good morning, brothers and sisters.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'd like to open to 1 Samuel chapter 22 this morning, brothers and sisters. Picking up from the place where we were last day and developing some of the final thoughts we'd like to consider in this first phase of David's life before we move on and consider the second phase, which we've discussed as we see it on the chart. 1 Samuel chapter 22 begins in verse 1 to tell us that David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. This is following, as you can see from the context, back in chapter 21, verses 14 and 15, from the time in which he removed himself from his quiet and comparatively undisturbed exile in Gath. Now David is back into the arena of activity where he belongs. And as he returns to the place where he should be, his move is reinforced, you'll notice, brothers and sisters, by the following. In verse 5, we read, And the prophet Gad said unto David, Abide not in the hold. Depart and get thence into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Hereth. Adullam was not in the heart of Judah. It was still very close to what we would call the border of the Shephelah, which was still very close to the shoulder of Philistine territory. It's obvious then, brothers and sisters, that it was God's intent, according to the words of Gad the seer, that David should now put himself and remain in that area of activity, working, as it were, with the ecclesia, with the brothers and sisters in Judah. What's interesting now is that there is a kind of change in the tide for David. Events begin ever so slowly to change in his favor. For, as we look at verses 1 and 2, we see that there begins to accumulate around David a kind of miniature ecclesia. It had all sorts. Those who came to David are described in verse 2 as those who were in distress, as those who had debts, as those who were discontented, and if you look at the margin, bitter of soul. There were no doubt in this mixture brothers and sisters that were faithful for the right reasons, drawn to David because they were repelled by Saul, drawn to David because he was the Lord's anointed, drawn to David because they saw in him the realization of their hopes, and they saw in him the right kind of leadership. But no doubt, as we look over those three terms in verse 2, those who were in distress, those in debt, those discontented, there was a mixed multitude as well. Within the ecclesia that gathers around David in miniature form, there were those who were there for the right reasons and those who were not there for the right reasons, whose motives, in some cases, were nothing other than being base motives. For others, higher motives. And insofar as that was a true cross-section of the condition of Israel at all times, and insofar as it describes really the condition of any ecclesia, any community in Christ, David was beginning now to receive some very direct training to become one day, fairly immediately, the king over Israel. He had been a shepherd in the hills of Judah. He had been in the court of Saul for a very short period of time. Now he was to receive increasingly an exposure to training to be a king and a shepherd over the nation. And those three words, brothers and sisters, are really quite appropriate in describing the true brothers and sisters who come to Christ. We come to him in distress. We come to him having debts which we cannot pay. We come to him also bitter of soul and discontented. Just hold your hand here, if you will, and just turn into Matthew's Gospel for a moment. It's interesting to read this statement by Jesus in Matthew chapter 11 in light of what we read here in 1 Samuel chapter 22 with this small group of people gathering around David of all sorts with all different types of problems and backgrounds. For Jesus beckons us to come to him out of the world, to leave behind us the governments of the world, at times necessary also to leave our own parental ties. And in verse 28 of Matthew chapter 11, he calls to us, "Come unto me, all ye that labor." And the word conveys the idea of agonizing, of being in a condition of difficulty. "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." He calls, brothers and sisters, to those who have been laboring in a way that is not successful. He calls to those who are in distress. He calls to those who cannot pay their debts in the spiritual sense. He calls to those who are discontented with what the world offers. And we are drawn to him in order to work and to labor with him. Back to 1 Samuel chapter 22. The number given to us in verse 2 is that there were about 400 men at this point. As we'll see when we look out beyond 1 Samuel 22 at some of the other accounts and chronicles, the numbers begin to swell very soon to 600. Over in chapter 23, if you'll take a look, verse 13, the number is given, in fact, as being 600. You might want to just perhaps put a pencil mark around that in verse 13, and likewise 400 around the area of 1 Samuel 22 and verse 2. Numbers are growing. As he stays in this area and moves on finally beyond it, support comes to David from some very unexpected quarters. I'd like just to take a look at where David begins to draw support from. Just hold your hand here, if you will, and let's just go over to 1 Chronicles. Commenting on this period, First Chronicles chapter 12. Now the statements in First Chronicles chapter 12 relate to this period by and large. We are told in First Chronicles chapter 12 verse 1 of those who came to David while he was in Ziklag. But we're also told in verse 8 of those who come to him when he is in the hold in the wilderness. And no doubt that is the time when he was in the area of Adullam. For look at verse 8, 1 Chronicles 12. "And of the Gadites, there separated themselves unto David into the hold to the wilderness, men of might and men of war fit for the battle, that could handle shield and buckler, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and were as swift as the roes upon the mountains." And names are given. Look at the loyalty of these kind of men that are drawn to David. Verse 14, "These were of the sons of Gad, captains of the host. One of the least was over 100, and the greatest over 1,000. These are they that went over Jordan in the first month, when it had overflown all his banks. And they put to flight all them of the valleys, both toward the east and toward the west." Sounds like the language of Hebrews chapter 11, doesn't it? "Who put to flight the enemies of God, who by faith waxed valiant in fight." David then, at this time, while he is in the hold, is beginning to draw supporters to him of the right sort. His army is beginning to swell, and his strength is no doubt being brought on here by not only numbers, but the quality of the people that are coming to him. Verse 16. It continues, and there came of the children of Benjamin and Judah to the hold, term used for Adullam, to the hold unto David. And David went out to meet them, and answered and said unto them, if ye be come peaceably unto me to help me. Now watch the terms that David uses, like that of the relationship between him and Jonathan. Mine heart shall be knit unto you. The language of 1 Samuel 18. But if ye be come to betray me to mine enemy, seeing there is no wrong in mine hands, the God of our fathers look thereon and rebuke it. Verse 18. Then the Spirit came upon Amasai, who was chief of the captains, and he said, thine are we, David, and on thy side, thou son of Jesse, peace. Peace be unto thee, and peace be to thine helpers, for thy God helpeth thee. Then David received them and made them captains of the band. David is doing what is right, removing himself from Gath, returning to the more immediate vicinity of where the ecclesia was. In concert with that, God brings him supporters. The tide changes. Men begin to dissolve away from Saul. He loses the support of the nation. The heart of the fighting force of the nation begins to melt away and leave Saul to himself to brood in his own moodiness. And these men trickle down in small numbers at times or in greater waves at times, willing even to get to David, notice, if they have to cross the Jordan at the time of its spring flood. So eager were they, so ambitious were they to come and support David. There was loyalty. Men drawn to the king, willing to do anything they could to come to his side and to support him. And they viewed themselves as helpers of the king. That truly, brothers and sisters, is the kind of call which we find as we read there in Matthew. Come unto me, says Jesus, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. Those who are in debt, those who are distressed, those who are discontented. But there's a certain amount of onus that is placed upon us as we are drawn to our King, the true Lord's anointed. We may not have to ford the rivers of the Jordan at springtime to get to Christ, but we do have to make an effort on our part. Same as when Christ was working during the ministry. As is so often said, he actually didn't always go out to the poor and needy and to the down and outs. He placed himself in an available position and expected them to be drawn to him. Some initiative was expected of those that were to come to him. And so we see, brothers and sisters, that although David has had a very discouraging period in this life as being a fugitive, there is a time now when the tide begins to change. And David is encouraged not only by the presence of ongoing friends as well as new ones, as we saw last day, he is also encouraged now by the swelling ranks that come to him at this time. And the more that come, bringing, of course, with them both good and bad, faithful and those who have mixed motives, David begins to have the task more and more of being a king over them. And he receives ecclesial training in a small way before he actually assumes the position of being the official, recognized king of the nation. Let's just go a little bit further. Back to Samuel, chapter 22. We have already mentioned the increasing numbers, but there's something else that transpires at this time. If we go over to chapter 23, verse 1, David shifts to the place called Keilah, still within the borders of Judah. Verse 1. Then they told David, saying, behold, the Philistines fight against Keilah, and they rob the threshing floors. Therefore David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go and smite these Philistines? And the Lord said unto David, go and smite the Philistines, and save Keilah. You see, brothers and sisters, when these people received David's assistance, they became victorious. You see what obviously was needed? They needed David, desperately. And here, David is given, really, a very practical rationale for his presence. Why had Gad the seer said to David, "Go, David, and remain in Judah. Get out of Gath, stay in Judah." Why? Well, here is a very good reason why he was to be drawn back to Judah. For in verse 1, the appeal from the people of Keilah was one of desperation. They needed David's help. In other words, in the ecclesial context, his brethren needed him. He couldn't help the people of Keilah had he remained in Gath. They were now being threatened by their inveterate enemies, and they needed their king. And so David, verse 2, you'll notice, follows proper procedure. Rather than being impetuous, as he had previously in marching off to Gath, here he carefully inquires of the Lord, "Shall I or shan't I?" And he receives a positive answer. But you'll notice in verse 3, David is facing internal difficulties. David's men said unto him, "Behold, we be afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we come to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" And David has to pray again. Verse 4, "And David inquired of the Lord yet again. And the Lord answered him and said, Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into thine hand." Now, between those verses, you have an interesting series of events. Number one, there's an appeal to David. "Troubled brethren, come and help us in our ecclesia," as it were. Verse 1, "We are troubled by the threats from the world." David asks, "Shall I go, Father, or shall I not go?" Yes, the answer obviously had come. But in the interim, once David's men, verse 3, are aware that David intends to respond to the appeal to assist the ecclesia in Keilah, within his own ranks there's fear. And the man who previously had feared Saul, the man who had previously feared Achish, now is encouraging his fellow brethren not to fear. Interesting, isn't it? David is now in a position of trying to overcome the fears of his brethren. They fear the men of Keilah. And in this response amongst his brethren in verse 3, it encourages David to go back in prayer again. He's being ever so cautious. Back he returns to the Father in prayer. Now, how does David receive an answer at this point? Just notice, as you go down to verse 6, "It came to pass when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech," this is the priest that fled, of course, during the slaughter of the priests at Nob, "came to pass when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David to Keilah, that he came down with an ephod in his hand." We read in verse 9, "David knew that Saul secretly practiced mischief against him, and he said to Abiathar the priest, Bring hither the ephod." Now notice what this adds to the account. Not only are numbers beginning to increase in David's ranks, not only are the people of Gad and the people of Benjamin, the mighty valiant men, now surging to David's presence, even willing to cross the Jordan to get to him at the wrong time of the year, but now the priesthood is with David. The priests from the other house, that is the house of Abiathar, have been destroyed with the exception of this one man. He has had to flee from Nob. The priesthood has virtually been wiped out. Only Abiathar really remains as the representative of that house. And he comes to David, and he joins himself to David at Keilah, and he brings the ephod. Now David has the priesthood with him. Interesting how David is being encouraged in his work. And now he has the additional benefit of having the ephod to communicate with Yahweh. And so David continues. Verse 10, "David said, O Yahweh, God of Israel, thy servant hath certainly heard that Saul seeketh to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me up into his hand? Will Saul come down as thy servant hath heard? O Yahweh, God of Israel, I beseech thee, tell thy servant." And Yahweh said, "He will come down." Then said David, "Will the men of Keilah deliver me?" and any men into the hand of Saul. And Yahweh said, they will deliver thee up. Sad, this comment on the men of Keilah. They had beseeched David for assistance. David had responded willingly. And yet, within this little community of Keilah, there was a great deal of unthankfulness. David did indeed assist them, but he realized that he couldn't stay there for very long. It wasn't terribly complimentary to the ecclesia at Keilah. They wanted help, but they didn't really wish to pay for that help. They wanted ecclesial assistance, but they were not willing to be loyal to David when pressure and circumstances made loyalty difficult. Notice, though, in the context of this problem, how careful David is in consulting God. Notice how he makes use of the ephod. He prepares his heart, he asks carefully, and every decision is checked by communication with the Father. Now, as we see, this does provide a contrast with weaker moments in David's life when such a careful procedure is not followed. Had he followed this kind of procedure prior to going to Gath? It would seem not. When he does follow this kind of procedure, this carefulness in prayer, he's blessed, and the right answers come. You see the point to ourselves, brothers and sisters. It's an exhortation as well against working or behaving impulsively, as easy as that is. Important and perhaps lesser important decisions for ourselves must be made with the same carefulness and preparation of heart as David exercised here. Brothers and sisters, we can never, as Bob has exhorted us, pray too much before we make a final decision. Not just on the larger scale of ecclesial appointments and policies, but within our own homes. Decisions that affect our lives with our children, our family, on a much smaller scale. That kind of carefulness in approaching the Father in prayer will ensure that our decisions are more carefully made and more likely to have God's direct blessing. Let us learn the lesson. It would seem David did, at least for this period of time especially. David's experiences, of course, move on to the area of Ziph, another place of the wilderness. Verse 14. David abode in the wilderness in strongholds and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him out every day, but God delivered him not into his hand. When David is in the right place, when he's working with the ecclesia the way he should be, he gets answers, he gets the right answers. When David is about and doing in the ecclesia and working with his brothers and sisters in the way that God intended, God works with him and delivers him from the hand of Saul. No need to despair. And it's here in verse 16. When Jonathan comes out, he strengthens David in the right and helpful way, as we've seen before. Verse 16, Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood and strengthened his hand in God. Look at the encouraging words. Verse 17. He said unto him, fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee, and that also Saul my father knoweth. Encouraging words. But now you see that David is receiving encouragement from all quarters, not just from individual friends like Jonathan, but now with the presence, the representative presence of the priesthood, now with clearly answered prayers, now with success against the Philistines in battling, of course, for Keilah, and now, of course, the ever-increasing support of manpower that he receives. We've said in passing, brothers and sisters, that it's useful to take a note of where the Psalms fit in. You might, in your margin here, next to Ziph, write in Psalm 54. The superscription of that psalm tells you that it was composed to celebrate this period of time when he was in Ziph. That's Psalm 54. Now, again, if you'll hold your place here, we receive an additional comment on this period of time when David is dwelling in the wilderness, in the hold, in Adullam, and in the other strongholds in the area. Behold your place here. Let's receive this insight. From 2 Samuel chapter 23. An incident recorded in 2 Samuel 23 about this time, but not recorded here in this context. 2 Samuel 23, verse 13. It provides a marvelous insight into the mind and the heart of David at this time. Verse 13. Of 2 Samuel 23. And three of the thirty chief went down and came to David in the harvest time unto the cave of Adullam. Now you might find it useful at that place where it mentions the cave of Adullam in 1 Samuel chapter 22 verse 1 to write into your margin there that you take a look at the additional information provided in 2 Samuel 23 verse 13 to about verse 17. Now let's just pursue this a little further. Three of the 30 chief men went down and came to David in the harvest time unto the cave of Adullam. And the troop of the Philistines pitched in the valley of Rephaim. The valley of Rephaim. Rephaim in Hebrew means giants. The Philistines pitched in the valley of the giants. And David was then in the hold. And the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. Did you notice that in verse 14? The Philistines are living in Bethlehem? It does tell us a great deal about the success of the Philistines up to this point. The Philistines lived on the shoulder along beside the Judean hills to the west, from there on into the area of the coastal area. That border or shoulder territory, known as the Shephelah, was really the domain of the Philistines. But at this point, it's obvious they had penetrated up through some of those valleys, like along the valley of Sorek, or the valley of Elah. Running from the coast, those river valleys penetrated across the Shephelah, the borderland, and up into the Judean range. And through those valleys, no doubt, they had managed at this point to get as far as Bethlehem and stake out a territory. Now you see what that's telling you, brothers and sisters? David is wrestling with more than one front. He's got the problems with Saul. He's got the responsibility of working with those that are dwelling with him as a kind of moving ecclesia. But he's got another problem. He's got the incursions made by the Philistines right into the heart of his country. They are now in the area of Bethlehem. David's problems are many, and he needs Yahweh's help to solve them. Here in the midst of this, look at this profession of loyalty. Verse 15, David longs out loud, "Oh, that one would give me drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Now, keep in mind what verse 14 has told you. Bethlehem is now under the control of the Philistines. And David yearns for a drink from that well out loud. Verse 16, "And the three mighty men break through the host of the Philistines." Break through the host. "And drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it, and brought it to David." Can you imagine that, brothers and sisters? The kind of loyalty that David had endeared to him. David was an incredible magnet amongst his men. He had, no doubt, a character that drew men to him and inspired in them a loyalty willing to even hazard their lives. You see the point? David, as a lesser figure, but a great shadow of the Lord Jesus Christ, could inspire in men a willingness to hazard their lives on his behalf. So David expresses out loud that he thirsts, how he would love to have a drink from the well of Bethlehem. "Right," say three men. They buckle on their armor. They leave David, and they burst through the host of the Philistines, time enough to get to that well, take the water, and bring it back safely, unharmed, to David. Such was the loyalty of these men that were now drawing themselves around David. Brothers and sisters, the Lord Jesus Christ does not ask us to risk our lives in foolish attempts, but as the King and the greater of the Lord's anointed, he does ask us to be willing to lay down our lives for the brethren. Not in daring attempts, which really don't amount to a great deal, such as this one. But if we are loyal to our King as they were loyal, we should be inspired, brothers and sisters, in a much even greater way, for the cause is greater, and the man we profess loyalty to is greater. Are we willing to hazard our lives for right and a just cause? Are we willing, as Bob has shown us in John's epistles, to lay down our lives for the brethren, and in particular, for our Master? David thirsted at this time as he lived in the wilderness like a chased dog, moving here, shifting there, no place to lay his head permanently. And in that sense, too, he paralleled the Master to a lesser degree, who said that he had no place to lay his head, no permanent abiding place, especially during the last year of his life. David, in a smaller way, walks in the steps of the Master. His life is one of uncertainty. He lives by faith, and he's encouraged by his fellow brethren, and by the ever-increasing support that he has now for the coming kingdom. He says in verse 17, he can't drink the water. Be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is not this the blood of the men that went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. These things did these three mighty men. An interesting insight, a little cameo, as it were, that pictures the kind of goings-on while David was in Adullam and while he was fleeing at this time in these various strongholds around the wilderness of Ziph and Maon. But David, you know, brothers and sisters, had a much more important thirst. Just look at Psalm 63, which comments on this period. Psalm 63. Here was the real thirst of the psalmist. The period is the same if you look at the superscription. You might want to put Psalm 63 in your margin around this point, either the time when he's at Adullam, or somewhere perhaps when you are over on in chapter 23, when he's in the wilderness of Ziph. For the superscription to Psalm 63 says that this is a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. So it would cover this whole period. Now notice the yearnings of David's soul. Verse 1. O God, thou art my God. Early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee in a dry and thirsty land, where no water is. Now picture that in its context, brothers and sisters. David was in the wilderness. He was in a dry and thirsty land. And there was a day during those weeks and months when he did say how he thirsted for the water of Bethlehem. But he thirsted for a more important water. Verse 2, what does he yearn for? Here's the mind and the heart of King David at its best. He yearned, verse 2, to see thy power and thy glory, not David's power, not David's glory, thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. Because thy loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise thee. Verse 5, my soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise thee with joyful lips. When I remember thee upon my bed, and meditate upon thee in the night watches. A man doesn't pray like that when he's at home in Bethlehem or Jerusalem. This is the prayer of a man on the run. A man who has to station watches to watch during the course of a night. Verse 6. The night was divided up into watches. David had men that acted as sentries, watching, always wary for Saul and his men creeping through the darkness. It's a man who was in jeopardy,
of his life. The only certainty that he had was the certainty that he had in faith with his Father. You see, brothers and sisters, in verse 9, "Those that seek my soul to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword, they shall be a portion for foxes. But the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone that sweareth by him shall glory, but the mouth of them that speak lies shall be stopped." The king shall rejoice in God. See how he's viewing himself now faithfully at this point. He is holding on firmly to those promises that were brought to his attention by Abigail, the sure house that was to be made for him. Here in the wilderness, at the peak, perhaps, of his strength during this period, David faithfully yearns and thirsts for the water of life. He thirsts to be in the presence of God. Now, when you read Psalm 63, brothers and sisters, and look back upon your own periods of indifference, when, for example, you have been undecided as to whether you should go to meeting on a particular morning, when you have wrestled with either turning off the television or going to Bible class, when you've wondered whether the money should be spent going to Bible school to strengthen yourselves and your family spiritually, as opposed to using that money for some other more selfish purpose, have you captured the spirit of David here? How he thirsted. But for what? Not simply the water in the wells of Bethlehem, as cool and as refreshing as they were. David, and this is what made him truly a man after God's own heart, yearned from the very well of his own being to be in the presence of God, to have fellowship with God, to be back in Jerusalem, to be able to go to meeting, to be in the temple, to be in the presence of the sanctuary, to find that peaceful repose with Yahweh that he truly yearned for. How he yearned to have a settled existence. How he yearned to be able to function properly in the ecclesia. How he yearned to be able to be available to God in the temple. Do you yearn for that? Do you have that kind of thirst? Well, Jesus says to us, the greater King, that we must have that kind of thirst. "Come unto me, all ye that thirst." So he told the woman as well, at the well. He wishes to find on us the same kind of thirsting. And where are we? We are in the wilderness of men, are we not? We are looking for the establishment of the kingdom, as David yearned. We are wishing for the time when the world will recognize the true king, as David was wanting that recognition. But in the interim, we find ourselves in the wilderness, like David. Let us, brothers and sisters, capture the soul, the spirit of David, as he truly yearned much more for the water of life, for that sweet fellowship. Let us not despise it, and let us find every opportunity we can to have that thirst quenched in the right way, from the right kind of well. David moves on in chapter 23 of 1 Samuel, to the area of Maon, south of Jerusalem, still in a wilderness area. Still a fugitive. We see, for example, in 1 Samuel chapter 23, that from Ziph, verse 24, he moves on into this new wilderness area of Maon. Verse 24, "They arose and went to Ziph before Saul. But David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the plain on the south of Jeshimon. Saul also and his men went to seek him. And they told David, wherefore he came down into a rock and abode in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon. And Saul went on this side of the mountain, and David on his men and his men on that side of the mountain. And David's men made haste to get away for fear of Saul. And Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about to take them." So the trap is set. Maon, by the way, is a raised hill. It was one of the outposts that ran along the border of the Shephelah, where the Judean hills began to break. It was used later on, at the time of Nebuchadnezzar's invasion, as a signal station, along with a number of other key towns and cities. A raised area, and somewhere on top of this hill, there was a rocky recluse where David now places himself. But being up on a raised area, he's vulnerable, for Saul and his men down below begin to encircle it. It's a trap. Perhaps up to this point, the most precarious position that David finds himself in. For he could look down from that rock in Maon and see Saul and his men encompassing it. And David is over to one side of the mountain. Saul encloses and encompasses round about. Verse 27. But. Key word. But there came a messenger unto Saul, saying, at the critical moment, haste thee and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land. Wherefore Saul returned from pursuing after David, and went after the Philistines. Therefore, they called that place, now watch the name, Selah Hamalakoth. Margin, the Rock of Divisions. Isn't that interesting? To celebrate David's deliverance from the hand of Saul, no doubt under David's direction, the name of the place of deliverance is called the Rock of Divisions. Now, brothers and sisters, there's a powerful amount of exhortation built into that. Just keep your hand here and look at that section in 2 Samuel chapter 22, which celebrates David's victories from the hand of Saul when it's all over with. And look at the language David employs. 2 Samuel chapter 22, verse 1 and 2. 2 Samuel 22. And David spake unto Yahweh the words of this song in the day that Yahweh had delivered him out of the hand of all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul. Now, looking back over the years, look at the language and the imagery which David employs. Verse 2. And he said, Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. He wasn't just idly pulling any kind of imagery out of the hat, as it were. David had been through these experiences like that in Maon. David had called the place Selah Hamalakoth, the Rock of Divisions. And who had made the division? Who had separated David from Saul's clutches at the critical hour? Yahweh had. And who was Yahweh? He was the Rock of David. And thus the imagery is drawing upon practical, real experiences in that life as a fugitive. Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. The God of my rock, in him, not the rock, not the hill of Maon, in him will I trust. He is my shield and the horn of my salvation, my high tower and my refuge, my Savior, thou savest me from violence. Never was there a more precarious predicament for David than when he was perched on this rock area on the top of Maon. And never was it more forcefully brought to David's attention that God was his rock. Look at 1 Chronicles chapter 11. At Adullam there was a rock, which came to David's mind, no doubt, also in this psalm. Verse 15. Now three of the 30 captains went down to the rock to David into the cave of Adullam, and the host of the Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim, in the valley of the giants. You see, brothers and sisters, how David viewed his God now as he comes to really the end of this phase of his fugitive existence, fleeing from Saul. For the tide, as we've said, is about to turn fully. The kingdom is very soon going to be within his grasp. David views God as a solid rock upon which to place his feet. And when David was doing what was right, he was delivered. When David was doing what was right, he found strength and refuge from God. He saw God not as a slippery rock,
not as one who was unpredictable, but one who could fully protect him when he viewed the incidents in faith. I'd like you, in conclusion, brothers and sisters, to turn to the words of Moses. Deuteronomy chapter 32. Give ear, verse 1, all ye heavens, and I will speak. And hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. My doctrine shall drop as the rain, my speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb, as the showers upon the grass. Because I will publish the name of Yahweh, ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are judgment. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. When we face difficulties and trial, when our faith is sorely tested, when we thirst for relief and help from the stress and strain of our difficulties, let us, brothers and sisters, turn over these experiences of David in our minds. Let us picture how David was at Maon, how it looked so inevitable that he would fall down into the clutches of his enemies below, how it was in the critical moment David found relief, how in the critical moment, providentially, a message was sent to Saul and his enemies were drawn back, how it was that David celebrated that deliverance amongst the rocks by looking upon his God as the rock. And how here Moses exhorts Israel to see God as communicating with his people, how his doctrine, his teachings, his word comes down to his people, verse 2, like the falling rain. How God's word is meant to water his people and how it is meant to bring growth and development. Look over in verse 18. The warning of the rock, Moses goes on to warn, of the rock that beget thee, thou art unmindful, and hast forgotten God that formed thee. Of the rock that beget thee, thou art unmindful. Was David? He was not. David celebrated his deliverance, not by thinking of it as pure chance, not by complimenting himself for his strategy or his own host or his own armor. David viewed and understood God to be working in his life. He was not unmindful of the rock that had begotten him. Brothers and sisters, let us cultivate the faith of David. Let us thirst and yearn as David did to be in the presence of God. Let us yearn for that coming kingdom. And in the meantime, let us, in the midst of our trials, the stresses, and the unfortunate circumstances of life, place our feet firmly on the rock of truth, upon the rock of our God. And let us not, as Moses warned, be unmindful of that great and mighty rock that has begotten us.